Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Louis Vincent Gave and Ira Harris. Louis co-founded GaveCal in 1999 with his father Charles and Anatoly Kaletsky. Since 2005, he has been mostly focused on the money management side of the business. Before co-founding GaveCal, Louis worked at Paribas Capital Markets, where he was equity research analyst from 1997 to 1999. Louis studied economics, history, and Chinese at Duke University and Nanjing University. In the past decade, Louis has written 5 books, including 2 different for Comfort. And Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us. Yeah, delighted to be here.
This is great. Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin with your view, Louis, on the global macro environment, on the economy and the financial markets.
Oh man, do you want to put a coin in that machine? Because I'm gonna set off. You're not gonna shut me up. Where to begin? I think one place to begin, because there's so many things going on right now, right? We're in the phase of accelerated deglobalization. We're in the midst of an energy crisis. I think we're looking down the barrel at a potential European crisis. There's, you can go down so many paths. But perhaps the simplest way is to start off where Ira left it with Zoltan Poznar just on their recent podcast. Because I think, Zoltan was early on, and I think very, very right in highlighting that, the recent financial decisions of the Western world vis-a-vis Russia represent a dramatic shift in the global financial architecture. And I think this has to be the starting point of your macro thinking today. To recap what has happened, I think you've seen a number of measures. The first measure, of course, was the decision by Western policymakers to freeze Russian central bank reserves. To me, this basically brings to a close, I would say, the post-Asian crisis period. We're all the fruits of our own experiences. I was in Asia at the time of the Asian crisis. And I think it's easy to underestimate, if you live in the Western world, what a traumatic event it was for not only for Asia, but for emerging markets in general. And in the space of a few weeks, entire middle classes were wiped out. And so the end result of this was that pretty much every emerging market out there decided never again. And to make sure that this never happens again, I need to accumulate US treasuries, for lack of a better word, which means I need to maintain an undervalued currency, make sure that I always have a trade surplus, and recycle this trade surplus in US treasuries. And here, to be very clear, the reason you bought US treasuries, if you were China, if you were Indonesia, if you were India, if you were Malaysia, if you were Brazil, if you were Chile, the reason you bought US treasuries was not because of the returns on capital. The returns on capital were, frankly, not that great and have kept getting worse every year. It wasn't because of the returns on capital. It was because of the safety of capital. It was the knowledge that whatever happens when things go bad, I'll have this safety cushion. And what just occurred, of course, is we just told Russia, this safety cushion you thought you had and that you might want to use now that you're at war, well, actually, you don't have it. And we're going to confiscate that from you. That's a very important message to say somebody like China. China, when Russia gets 200 billion of its reserves confiscated, China's immediate reaction is going to be, wait, what? I got 1.5 trillion of these things. And right now, they're giving me the worst returns on capital of any investment through history. I'm basically guaranteed minus 5% real for as far as the eye can see. But I'm basically, I'm sucking up the minus 5% real because of this perceived safety of capital. And what we've just found out is that the safety of capital actually depends who you are, on who you are, which will leave a lot of people, whether you're China's, you're Saudi Arabia's, feeling very uncomfortable. Imagine if you're, you know, Saudi Arabia, and you think, what if tomorrow there's another 9/11 because 20 imbeciles decide to fly planes into buildings? Does that mean that my reserves get confiscated? And so that's your first massive shift. And I'll come to the consequences in a little bit. The second massive shift, which I think is perhaps even more important than the central bank reserves, has been the confiscation of the oligarchs' assets. And here, the reality is, if you think of what is the Western world's comparative advantage, I would say that the rule of law ranks right up there. The fact that, you know, you can be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, or black, white, yellow, brown, it doesn't matter. You know, when you get in front of a court of law, whether in New York or in London or in Paris, you're going to have the same fair shake as anybody else, except that what we've just said now is, you know, you can be brown, white, yellow, except if you're Russian. Except if you're Russian, then we're going to confiscate your assets. And of course, you know, if you're Chinese, if you're Saudi, you're going to say, wait, what do you mean except if you're Russian? That's not the deal. Because if I'm a rich Chinese tycoon, and I've spent the past 10 years buying real estate in Vancouver and in London and in Sydney, and now I see that the Russian get their real estate confiscated because Putin decides to invade Ukraine, I wonder, well, what if tomorrow Xi Jinping decides to invade Taiwan? You know, does my shit get confiscated? Even though I obviously have no input on Xi Jinping's actions, nor do I have any insights. But, you know, it could very well be that, I don't believe Xi Jinping's going to invade Taiwan. But, you know, if I'm a rich Chinese guy with assets all around the Western world, I'd worry about it. Which brings me to the third massive decision that's unfolded in the Western world, is that against all this, Switzerland basically tore up 150 years of neutrality and jumped on the confiscating of Russian oligarchs' assets bandwagon. And so that makes it all the more troubling, because if you're, you know, I think if you were any oligarch anywhere in the world, you always felt, well, if worse comes to worse, my account in Switzerland is always safe. I mean, after all, these are the guys who kept bank accounts for the Nazis, even after the atrocities of the Nazis were discovered. You know, the Nazis who managed to make it down to Brazil or down to Argentina kept, you know, they kept access to their Swiss money. But here we go with the oligarchs' accounts in Switzerland now frozen. So all this matters because we've lived in a sort of odd world since the Asian crisis, whereby you had basically excess savings in poor countries through the form of always current account surpluses that were always recycled into rich countries for the perceived safety of capital. It wasn't because of the returns on capital, it was the perceived safety of capital. And so we had an odd world where, in essence, poor countries were subsidizing consumption in rich countries. And this has gone on for really the past 25 years. And the reality is this is now gone. This is now over. Because if you're from a dodgy country, which might be Qatar, might be Bahrain, might be sorry about this. It's probably on my side because of this darn storm. But I was just saying, if you're from a dodgy country, a Saudi Arabia, a China, etc., and you really have no visibility on the policies of your leaders for the foreseeable future, the takeaway from all of this is redeploying capital in the Western world may not be as safe as you thought it was. And this at a time when the returns on capital are already, you know, at record lows because of current valuations on most of Western assets, starting, of course, with the bond markets. Now, against this backdrop, you have basically Putin that comes out and says, you know what, guys, I'm going to create a new parallel operating financial system, because the, you know, before 1971, we lived in a dollar gold backed world. Post 71 and the depegging of gold, we then lived in essence in a US asset backed system, where the US would run big current account deficits and foreigners would fund this deficit and buy US treasuries, buy US real estate, buy US equities. It was a US asset backed system. Putin's response to being embargoed is to say, well, look, if you guys want to have access to my commodities and you're not from a friendly country, you can either pay them in your local currency if I like you, i.e. if you're China, if you're India, if you're Brazil, if you're South Africa, you can buy my commodities in your local currency and that's fine. We're going to de-dollarize the commodity trade. And if I don't like you, then you have to come and pay me in rubles, and you can get rubles for by giving me gold. You give me a gram of gold, I give you 5,000 rubles. So for the first time since 1971, Putin is trying to create a direct link between gold and oil. Now, it doesn't mean that he'll be successful, but what we're very clearly seeing is, on the one hand, well, we definitely have a new Iron Curtain that has fallen across Europe, with Russia and Belarus on one side, everybody else on the other. And you have Western democracies that are very busy trying to tell emerging markets, whether you're India's, you're China's, you're Brazil's, trying to tell them, come and join us on our side of the Iron Curtain and blockade Russia with us. And a lot of these countries are saying, well, you know what, I don't really feel like it, because I sort of need what Russia produces, or this is actually a good opportunity for me to get energy on the cheap at a time of a crisis. And that brings you to the question, of course, is why aren't emerging markets reacting more, I would say, honorably to the scenes of horror that we're witnessing in Ukraine? And here, you know, we have to acknowledge very, very marked cultural differences. You know, I think if you're European like I am and you see these images in Ukraine, you have two reactions. The first is, oh shit, here we go again. You know, it's like, you know, like tanks rolling through Europe bring back a sort of historical memory that's not very happy. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing that it brings back, you know, I used to be, you mentioned, an officer in the French army. I was an officer in the mid 1990s, and you know, the Berlin Wall had fallen, but yet every exercise we did was always, you know, Ivan is sitting on top of the hills with some T-72 tanks, Boris is hiding in the forest. So everything we did was conditioned to the idea that Russian tanks were going to come rolling in, and now that they are, we were like, you know, like, I knew it. Like, you know, I knew this was going to happen. But of course, you know, if you grew up in Brazil, if you grew up in China, you never grew up thinking Russian tanks are going to come rolling in. So you weren't sort of embedded with that fear. Anyway, so you get a very different response from emerging markets, which means that we could easily move to a world where you have, on the one hand, developed markets that, you know, increasingly trade just together, that practice financial repression with -5% real on bonds. And so if you're American, you're told, you know what, if you don't like my -5% real on bonds, you can go to Europe where you can also get -5% real, or you can go to Japan where you can also get -5% real. But those are basically your options. And then you'll have emerging markets that increasingly, I think, are moving to a parallel trading system that is no longer US asset backed, but that will increasingly be commodity backed, backed by oil and by energy. And that's how trade will be evolving in emerging markets. And that leaves you with, I think, the most important question of all, and I'm sorry I'm being long-winded. I told you, if you put a coin in the machine, I'll be off. but that leaves you with the most important question today, which is that for 25 years, emerging markets have accumulated copious amounts of US dollars. They've built these safety mattresses of massive amounts of dollars, mostly held in US treasuries, but also in mortgage bonds and in US assets. And they've done this on the premise that holding assets in the US was the safest thing you could do. And now all of a sudden, you know, that view is being reconsidered. So in terms of flows, you know, it means that emerging markets may think, you know what, there's no point in me running big trade surpluses anymore. I should let my currency go up and have a big domestic consumption boom, which needless to say would increase inflationary pressures, et cetera. So in terms of flows, there might be changes already in the policies. And then there's in terms of stocks, it's like, what do we do with these all these excess US dollars that we've accumulated for 25 years? There's a case to be made that maybe these dollars come back to the US and that basically, you know, emerging markets say, you know what, I don't want these US treasuries anymore, and cash out of them. And if that's the case, then you end up with a world where all this money flows back into the US, all this liquidity. So US treasuries go down, but other asset prices might go up a lot. You know, maybe that's what we're witnessing already in the markets. Commodities obviously go through the roof, and inflation in the US really goes bonkers because all these dollars that were sitting outside of the US now come back in. So long-winded answer to your question, but to me, the bottom line is, you know, we could be moving from a unipolar system based on US assets to a duopolar, to a dual system, or even manifold system with lots of different currencies starting to pick up more and more of the global trade. And so the bottom line is, you know, is the US in the process of losing a lot of its comparative advantages? The first comparative advantage was the rule of law. I think the grabbing of people's assets without due process is problematic. And the other was, of course, having the world's reserve currency and being able to run massive twin deficits without any constraints. Is that now going to be challenged going forward?
Wow, fascinating and great.
Historical. Sorry, long-winded answer.
And you have thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, Lewis, don't ever apologize. So let's take off from there. So that, of course, as you continue to talk about, brings us to Zoltan's view about the importance of shipping, of course, and commodities and the pricing of commodities. And again, you know, you sit and watch from a French perspective. Now I'm almost 69 years old. So I watched one of your alumni, Dalab Singh, on 60 Minutes. I didn't watch it in real time. So many people sent it to me. And as I watched it, you know, people, of course, the opening statement was, well, he's explaining the sanctions. And it's so good to feel that at least we have people who are really bright who are doing this. My sense was not that at all. My sense was that you're an arrogant piece of shit. And you represent an arrogance of America that resonates poorly with me, because I go back to the 60s. I was a child of that. And as I watched him, I thought of Robert McNamara. And then I jump to David Halberstam, probably one of the last great journalists that walked this earth, who wrote The Best and the Brightest. And that's what I'm watching him. And they're so sure about what they're doing and how they take off on this and how they're going to punish Russia. And actually, the interviewer did ask a very important question. Are these sanctions an act of war? Now, that's what I thought was the critical question, because if it is, you are now sacrificing Ukrainian people without you being willing to sacrifice. See, I thought that Biden made a critical mistake in January when he said that not one U.S. soldier would be on Ukrainian soil. That was a month before, right?
Well, you know, look, I think the message from the U.S. has been pretty clear from the get-go is, you know, they'll fight Russia to the last European. yeah. And so, you know, let's not kid around here that, you know, all these Russian sanctions, they actually don't hurt the U.S. that much. You know, the U.S. exports as much to Russia as Belgium does. just to put things in perspective, you know, for the U.S., this doesn't really matter. You know, the U.S. is energy self-sufficient, right? I mean, more or less. And so you could say, well, energy prices rise and that hurts the consumer. But all that means is in the old days when energy prices rose, it meant money left the U.S. to go to Nigeria or to go to Saudi Arabia. Now, when energy prices rise, it means money leaves New York for Texas or Michigan for Oklahoma. Right. You know, as within the U.S., it doesn't really matter. So, yeah, the U.S. is in a pretty good position here to fight to the last European, because for Europe, let's not beat around the bush. This is an absolute disaster. It's a disaster in terms of supply chains. It's a disaster in terms of trades. And, you know, you mentioned shipping. You know, one of the things that I think people don't realize is the extent to how much rail transport from Europe to Asia has grown, thanks partly to China's One Belt, One Road, et cetera, in the past 10 years. You know, if you're Volkswagen, your biggest factory is actually now in China, but you produce all the auto parts still in Germany and Eastern Europe, and you put them on train, and in 6 days, they're at your factory in China, and you put the car together. Well, now it's going to take 6 weeks by boat, assuming you can find a boat, and assuming you can find port space in Rotterdam. So, you know, there's a lot of trade that needs to be rerouted that just wasn't planned for, and you can't just do it at a click, of a finger. But I want to come back to the hubris you mentioned. Because indeed, you could say, look, we've seen hubris everywhere. You know, 12 months ago, the Fed was telling us, oh, don't worry, if inflation comes around, we have all the tools to bring it in line, right? So, you know, it's like everywhere you care to turn, it's, you know, if you know, growing your monetary policy, you start growing your M2 by 26% and running 9% budget deficits and thinking, yeah, you know what, if inflation comes around, we'll be able to control it. You know, if that makes sense to you, then obviously you have hubris, which is where all the central banks were. But, you know, going on to the Ukraine, oh, sorry, forgot to turn that off. Going to the Ukraine response, I don't know if it's hubris or if it's panic. And let me explain. When COVID happened, I wrote a piece entitled CYA, the guiding principle of our time. CYA standing, we're amongst friends, so I can be a little crass, standing for cover your ass. And here, you know, what we witnessed, I think, with COVID was the extent that the power of social media in general, that basically we moved to a world where something bad happens, 50,000 people on Twitter get together and say something must be done. And so, you know, politicians look around and say, well, you know, that's something, like locking people inside their homes, that's something. So let's do that, like regardless of whether it works or not. But something must be done, and something must be done quickly. So what we've witnessed, I think, in recent years is the pace of policy making accelerate dramatically. And, you know, COVID was the prime example of this, where, you know, new measures would be announced, and before they were even implemented, and before we even had the chance to see if these measures worked, you'd have a new set of measures announced. It's like every week brought its new sets of measures, because the clamor on social media was something must be done, something must be done. And here again, we have something horrible that happens, you know, Russia invading Ukraine. And so the clamor comes out and says something must be done. And so, you know, over the course of a weekend, basically, you know, Chrystia Freeland, the Canadian finance minister, and Mario Draghi decide, well, there's something I must, well, let's freeze their reserves. That's something. So let's do that without even thinking of the potential long-term consequences. Let's block the oligarchs' assets. That's something. Nobody likes these guys anyway. They're assholes. So let's just confiscate their money without even thinking of what the long-term consequences of that means. You know, it's something, so let's do it. And we'll deal with the long-term consequences later. So I'm not sure it's as much hubris as just sheer panic. And you move from panic state to panic state. And as you do, more often than not, you just destroy the very basis of how our societies have functioned for years and years. You saw this with COVID. You know, let's lock kids in, even though, you know, kids don't die of COVID. Let's cancel schools. And if that means we sacrifice a generation, then so be it. And so, you know, you move from it's like panic response after panic response after panic response. And so, and you're seeing it again with COVID. Now, the big difference this time around is that with COVID, you know, they could claim, oh, we're following the science, for whatever that means, because, you know, there is no such thing as the science. There's scientists who debate every issue, science is a trial and error process. But there is, but here they'll have to own this one. And the reality is, you know, through just sheer panic responses, they're undermining the very strengths of the Western world, the rule of law, the reserve currency status that took generations to be established, et cetera. And you know that this is all seems to be happening very quickly. And so lo and behold, you have US treasuries that fall every day, German bunds that fall every day. To me, that makes sense. It's if you're basically underpinning the very financial architecture that have held these asset prices up to, you know, to much higher levels of valuation than otherwise would warrant, you know, they're cutting down the branch they're sitting on.
I think that's right. And again, so you, and your point is well taken that you get, you know, Friedland, who I think just flies by. I'm not a big fan of hers. I didn't like what she did with the truckers and the way she froze.
It was horrendous. Horrendous. It was
terrible. And then right now, as we're talking, with the no buying of, by foreigners who don't reside in Canada of homes, really, if you have a housing crisis, you may as well go to Bank of Canada and say, well, why don't you raise overnight rates to 3%? And we and force an issue of putting 50% down. And I guarantee you, you curtail it without that. So yeah. I think she's arrogant. That's I thought when she used to write for the FT, you know, when she had to start every other column with that she went to Harvard, you know, and the fact that I know that she went to Harvard is a mistake. So we reside there. So we are in this morass. And you're right. Say they jumped. And the U.S. had these in place. So they put the sanctions in place. And from a pure MBA like Dalip Singh brings, yeah, they work. But the collateral damage is far different. And that's
do they work though? I mean, if you're Russia, do they really work? We've seen the ruble, it's now back to its previous. I'm sorry to interrupt, but they're working right now in, you know, planting the seeds for a massive crisis in Europe. That's what they're working for. Russia's ability, you know, the whole point of sanctions is, you know, when you're going to impose them, that the idea is you're going to impose more pain on the guy that is taking the sanctions than the guy that's imposing them, right? Yeah. Otherwise, what's the point? Otherwise, you're cutting your nose to spite your face. Now, as far as the U.S. is concerned, there's no doubt that these sanctions don't hurt the U.S. too badly. But if you look at the EU-Russia balance on these sanctions, I'm not sure the EU comes out ahead on this. The EU might be a bigger loser than Russia ends up being.
100%, I agree with that. And again, but from a sanitized viewpoint, oh, we're making the Russians, we're really causing them harm. We're not. But that's the MBA format. The more Louis Gavet, Ira Harris, anybody, Zoltan, when we look at things for the global macro, the world looks far different. You know, I'm a big reader of Fernand Braudel. And yep. I have sitting next to me Giovanni Arrighi. I mean, yep. these are phenomenal. And they're not thinking in those terms. They're thinking in a much bigger, broader base rather than what the narrow McKinsey study may tell you about what these sanctions may do. And you and I think the last time we talked about China creating a digital currency backed by a precious metal. You know what? It's not, China will learn from this. But Russia has basically has now a precious metal backed currency, whether you do it in grams or ounces. Yep. This disrupts the entire Keynesian format, I would say, certainly we can go to one of our favorites, Jacques Roux, and we can discuss all this stuff. And are we on a gold exchange system? Well, the whole Keynesianism was to get away from that, but you're now bringing it back, and the world is going to be greatly disrupted because it won't just be, I believe it'll be a bimetal world, by the way. I believe that the Chinese have designs, and you don't have to do it. It's not 100%. If you gave me a currency today that was certifiably backed by 10% gold, I guarantee you I'd own your currency.
Yeah, it'd be better. It'd be better than being backed by the ability of a government to tax, when you know that most of these governments have been running structural budget deficits for one or two generations now. So their ability to tax, you know, to the extent that they're already spending, is already massively constrained. So,
yes, you're making it possible. So you're building it into the system. Yep. And you know what? I know everybody was, you know, when they took shots, so they took shots at my favorite central banker, Elvira, who, you know, she supposedly wanted to leave. And of course, you know, Putin wouldn't let her leave.
Yep.
But they've been, they're, and Putin's, that was a masterstroke to demand payment in rubles.
Oh, look, but it was a masterstroke, but it was so bloody predictable. I mean, yeah, but it was so, you know, if you tell a guy, look, you know, we're going to confiscate your US dollar, we're going to confiscate your euros, then he's left with two choices: pay me in rubles or pay me in renminbi. I mean, those were the two choices, right? Or pay me in gold, which in essence is what he said, right? He said, pay me in ruble, and nobody has rubles. You know, who's got rubles out there? So he said, and if you need rubles, you know, you need to give me gold. So yeah, you know, I think this is a very brutal shift and very sudden shift in the global financial architecture, which means that, you know, when you look at it, I don't think the Western world can accept that. You can't accept to have a gold-backed currency competing with your fiat currency. You just can't. So that leaves you with three possible outcomes. The first is Putin has to be defeated, whatever the cost. And militarily, that's going to be a tough one. So you know, that's option one. Option two, if he can't be defeated, he has to be isolated as much as possible. And hence, you know, the pressures put on China, the pressures put on Brazil, the pressures put on India, etc., to disavow Putin. But, you know, so far the Western world, you know, isn't doing that great, partly because, diplomatically speaking, we don't have a lot of chips to cash in with a lot of these countries. You know, we've spent the past 5 years browbeating China, destroying their national champions like Huawei and etc. You know, the U.S. is not seen as a friend in China today. So when the U.S. comes in and says you have to disavow Russia, you know, the response in Beijing is say, okay, so you want me to turn away from the one friend I have so that you can destroy him, and once you've destroyed him, you're probably going to destroy me. Yeah, that makes sense. Let me get right on that. So, you know, we don't have a lot of diplomatic chips to cash in with emerging markets in general. Let's not forget that less than 10 years ago, we had the taper tantrum where, you know, things got very dicey for places like India, for places like Indonesia, for places like South Africa, for places like Brazil, all these big emerging markets that were looking down the barrel of bankruptcy during the taper tantrum, you know, probably walked away thinking it would be nice to be less dependent on the US dollar. And now Putin gives them this very opportunity. So, you know, so the second option is to try to completely isolate Putin and make sure that his system doesn't work. But that's a tough one. And the third option is basically you need to reach a compromise with Putin where you say, okay, fine, you can have half of Ukraine, but you drop your ruble for gold. You drop your ruble for gold plan. And I think that's the path we're going to go down. And it'll be interesting to see if Putin says, no, I'm going to stick to the ruble with gold plan, because actually I think that's in my long-term interest. Thank you very much. So it'll be interesting which way Putin goes. But I think if you're, you know, the EU, if you're even the US Treasury, that's the path you have, you know, that's the path you have to go down, because the alternative is World War III. The alternative is World War III. But, you know, when you look at the funding needs of the EU, the funding needs of the US, you can't have a gold-backed currency, because it just crumbles the system. So you just can't. So, you know, Putin's got to, you know, I think in they either have to isolate him or you know, reach a compromise. And so the challenge, I think, for Western policymakers is a pretty simple one, is if you want to isolate him, you have to make him out to be the new Adolf Hitler, you know, to be killing all these civilians, to be this huge monster of this war criminal, etc. And you know, that's part of the rhetoric. But if you go down that path, that means reaching any deal becomes really complicated, right? You can't, on the one hand, describe a guy as the next Adolf Hitler and say, "Oh, it's okay," and the week after say, "Oh, it's okay, we have a deal now, and sure. And everything is good." It's you know, either he's the Antichrist, and we have to fight him to the death, or we can grab a deal. And for now, clearly the media rhetoric is pointing towards he's the Antichrist. And there's no deal. And shame on you if you're China, shame on you if you're India, shame on you if you're Brazil, shame on you if you're South Africa, shame on you if you're Iran, shame on you if you're Turkey for dealing with this Antichrist.
And you know what? It's interesting. Richard, can I go here?
Go ahead. Yeah, go
ahead. So as we talk today, you know, what just came out is that the Turks have decided not to try the killers of Khashoggi. I think this is a very significant.
Oh, I missed that.
Oh yeah, it came out this morning. Yeah. So they're walking away, which I've never understood why you keep pushing this anyway. When you come back and then this is the arrogance of the United States.
I wonder how much that cost MBS. Must have been a nice check for Erdogan.
how they're trying to reestablish their relations. So yeah. Things are crumbling underneath. What the United States wants to put forth as a very successful facade. It's not successful. And the ruble is the beginning of it, by the way. I can look at the ruble and, you know, Jen Psaki can tell me whatever they want about manipulating currencies. Meanwhile, I watch the Australians who talk about how great their economy was and hold rates at 10 basis points on Monday night or Tuesday in Australia. So you want to talk to me about manipulating currencies? I watch what the Japanese have done, which I certainly don't understand what Kuroda is thinking about. And I don't think the Ministry of Finance does either. I think there's a burgeoning battle. It's because the Bank of Japan has gone down that route. And with Zoltan, we actually talked about, and I know it's something that'll be dear to your heart.
Can I give you my potential explanation on this one?
Yeah.
On the yen. Japan actually has a massive golden opportunity. All the big European multinational companies that operate in China now have massive supply chain dislocations because the railways no longer work. So you have to ship, etc. There's now a window of opportunity for Japanese companies to basically clean up the Chinese market. And so you come in with a weak yen and with supply, and you wipe the floor clean with the European, like you basically wipe them out of the market. So I think it's a once in a generation opportunity for Japan to kick Europe out of Asia. Not in the way as they did back in 1940 with troops and whatever else. This time it's just to do it. You do it with cheap currencies and supply chains that aren't dislocated, unlike Europe's. And by the way, which is another huge issue for Europe going forward, because if you kick Europe out of Asia, what's left for Europe? So I think that's what's unfolding. It's good old fashioned mercantilist commercial warfare. They sense the weakness in Europe, and it's time to put it to the sword.
You know what? I'm so glad you went there. Because we, Zoltan and I talked about it, and I know you'll jump out of your seat when you listen to it. Because we go back to 1994, or December 31st, 1993, when this, I know this is going to impact you. On December 31st, 1993, the day before the Chinese depreciated the yuan by 50%.
Yep.
The yen yuan was at 19.22 yen to the yuan.
Yeah.
Right now, 19.48. We have just taken out 27. Well, we made higher highs and when the Chinese were busy trying to figure out what they were going to do with the yuan back in 2015. But that caught, we had a long discussion about this. So when you say kick your, You know what? I didn't think of it in that regard. And the fact that the Chinese are allowing it, because I'll tell you what, we go back then to 1998 in June, which was a very critical period. I don't know if you were, you started in 1989, of course. Yeah. You know what? So on the Bill Clinton trip to Beijing, which is a very important point to me in global macro, because what happens, Bill Clinton's going to China.
It becomes clear that China will join the WTO at that point.
Yeah. And the yen had been weakening, because we know what was going on in Japan, and was weakening against yuan. And what happens? Bob Rubin, who 3 weeks prior to that trip talked about the importance of the strength of the dollar, right before Bill Clinton lands in China, the U.S. starts selling dollar yen, because the Chinese were very upset at the weakness of the yen against especially the Asian currencies. I mean, you were living it.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely. No. Look, 98 was a very tough time in China. Tough time all around Asia with the Asian crisis, etc. But I want to go back to your point on China allowing it. I think if you're China, your very long-term view is that you can try to be friends with Europe, but deep down, Europe will always have the option of blocking China. It'll always have the option of doing embargoes, and Europe will most likely fall in line with whatever the US decides. That's got to be the default mode. Japan is an easier long-term picking, because Japan doesn't have a choice but to be in Asia. You know, Europe can be in Asia, it cannot, it can decide. Japan doesn't have a choice, it is in Asia. And so if you're China, your long-term strategy has to be to make friends with Japan. It has to be. And so, you know, Europe can come and go. Japan will always be here to stay. So you have no choice but to make friends with Japan. So when you say, I can't believe that China allows the yen to devalue to basically win market share in China. Well, if you're China, do you think for the very long term, would I rather be dealing with Japanese corporates or European corporates? It makes more sense to deal with the Japanese, because you'll always be able to put pressure on them.
It's a great point. So when I people and I go, the most significant going on here, what the BO especially seems to be targeting is the euro yen, because the advantage, yeah, the old mercantile, that's the G model, right? Weaken the currency and I'll operate at zero profit for longer than you can tolerate it. And
Because Japan doesn't compete with the US on a lot of stuff. Right. You know, I know in the US people like to think, we compete with, you know, Toyota and we compete with Honda, etc. But the real competitor for Toyota is not General Motors or Ford. The real competitor is Volkswagen, because the growth markets is really emerging markets at this point. And so the real competitors for Japan, you know, if you look at machine tools, if you look at specialty steels, specialty chemicals, autos, robotics, most of them are in Europe. They're not so much. And it's, when I say Europe, it's actually, you know, all of European industry. You really start, you do an axis from Turin to Milan, and you make a rectangle that goes straight north. You basically capture Eastern France, all of Switzerland, most of Germany, Denmark, and the southern bit of Sweden. And that's basically, you know, that's Japan's competitor right there. Mm-hmm. What was in Charlemagne's old empire, Lombardia, is really the European industrial heartland. Basically, from Milan to Stockholm, you draw a line and you go 50 miles on either side, and you've got all of Europe's industry. That's Japan's competition right there, not the U.S.
Yeah, it's like what I used to, when I, back in the early 90s, when you could see what the Japanese were doing with Lexus, they went exactly at Mercedes. Lexus was meant to compete with Mercedes. And I know, because I tried to buy American automobiles. I bought a Cadillac, I bought a Lincoln.
What would you do that for?
1992, I bought the first Lexus, or it was the second year of the Lexus LS400.
And you haven't turned back.
I go, am I out of my mind? Am I really, have I lost? I said, I bought these cars compared to this, and, yes, and they were priced absolutely to target Mercedes. They could care less about Cadillac or Lincoln.
Yeah.
They went after the upper end by pricing themselves with a high. So your words are just phenomenal. And that, so I love that. Kick Europe out of Asia. That's a great phrase, you know, and it's taking place. So,
well, it's the window of opportunity right now. So I think, to be honest, you have to own the Japanese exporters at these levels. First, they've sold off. The yen is very cheap, and they're going to clean up in China. You know, the Toyotas of this world, the Cayennes, the robotic stocks. You have to own these guys.
And they're going to do it with. They don't even need electronics because they're working so much on the hydrogen. I know how much money that. And you know, it's funny you say it because one of my, I don't own any American banks. I don't own any, but I actually have been buying Mitsubishi on every setback. There's just something to me. It's so friggin' cheap. They pay a nice dividend for you, know, almost a 4% dividend. And if the yen cheapens, I can't believe that some of these large global investors don't go after some of these Japanese banks. I know there's not many of them left because there's been so much consolidation and all the stuff that went on with Phoenix. Who is that with what's his name back?
I think it's been such a widow maker, right? The buying the Japanese banks. It's terrible. People have been burned so many times that you need a lot of guts to bring a Japanese bank to an investment committee today, which, you know, probably means it's right, because if you can, you know, but it takes a lot of guts. I'd rather own the exporters, the Toyotas and the Cayennes.
You're right. It's just, as I tell people, when they say, oh, you like that? I said, it's dead money. I should be whipped for as long as I've been in them. But the dividends, I said, okay, it's like owning a bond. That's what it is. I don't own the equity. I own a bond.
Yeah.
They pay, you know, and every once in a while they'll up the dividend. But now I'm looking at it and I go, if the yen keeps getting cheaper and cheaper, there are going to be Japanese assets at fire sale. And I think that the BOJ has to be careful with that. Yeah. That there's a two-edged sword. And I just put up the euro yen, which is, you know, being an old, I traded so many yen in my life. In fact, I just got a settlement out of a spoofing case that somebody did with euro yen. I just got a settlement. So, you know, you look at that chart and yeah, we're making on this chart, we've approached, 10-year highs in the euro yen. So your theory,
good news for Toyota.
Your theory is unbelievably right. And that's the headline, kick Europe out of Asia.
Yeah.
I love that. I truly love that. I think you're so right on target with that. So you see Japanese stocks and therefore the Nikkei itself must deem as pretty cheap anyway.
Yes. Yeah. No, look, I love buying undervalued assets in undervalued currencies. It's now the yen is about as undervalued as any currency, as any major currency I've seen in my career today. And you know, the Japanese equity market is also fairly attractively valued. Now, you know, within the Japanese market, you have different pockets. I tend to like the exporters more because it's a play. I think there's two catalysts to it. The first catalyst is, of course, the weak yen. And the second is the supply chain dislocations that European multinational companies are going to suffer across Asia, which is, you know, today, if you're a Chinese buyer of machine tools, you're going to buy from Japan rather than buy from China, from Germany, almost regardless of the price, because you know that Japan is going to deliver and you're not sure that Germany will.
Let me follow up with you. So one of the most interesting charts for me is the Swiss yen. Yep. Because the Japanese and the Swiss compete in some very significant markets.
For sure.
Because they both excel, just like they do with the Germans, in re-engineering high quality products as well as pharmaceuticals. So It's interesting because I'm looking at the Swiss yen chart, and I think you should take a look at it too. So if I go back to the magic month of January of 2015, when the S&P pulls the peg, the Swiss yen actually on that week went up to 150 yen.
Now there's, yen. I think when you look at Switzerland, there's a new uncertainty, right? Because the rules have just changed in Switzerland. You know, one of the key advantages was that, you know, here was the one place in the world where I could always have my money and it would always be mine, regardless of what happened anywhere in the world. And that has just changed. And so, you know, to some extent, you know, the Swiss National Bank has spent the past 10 years intervening every day in the market, selling Swiss francs, getting US dollars and euros that it has then used to buy equities everywhere, right? It's, you know, it's one of the top 10 holders of every of the 50 large cap stocks in the world. It's been amazing because when you think of it, Switzerland has in essence built itself a sovereign wealth fund because that's what it is. I think it's something like $200 billion sovereign wealth fund simply out of the strength of its currency. You know, most people to build a sovereign wealth fund, they have to sell oil, sell natural gas. You know, that's what happened with Adia. That's what happened with Norges in Norway. Here, Switzerland, they just sell their currency. It's just because people want the safety of the Swiss franc and they're willing to pay for it and they're willing to, you know, pay up. But is that still the case? Big question mark. You know, for the past 10 years, the Swiss National Bank has sat on the bid on of the top 50 largest market caps and stocks in the world. You know, every day would come in and say, yep, I'm a buyer of Apple, I'm a buyer of Amazon, I'm a buyer of LVMH, I'm a buyer of Alphabet. And this because every day it had to intervene to keep the Swiss franc down. If now, if I'm a rich Saudi guy, Saudi prince, I think, you know what? I don't want my account in Switzerland anymore. I'm going to put it in Dubai. I'm going to put it in Singapore. I'm going to put it in Hong Kong. I'm going to spread it out some because I'm no longer that safe. You know, there is no one jurisdiction that is that safe. So I need to spread my wealth. The Swiss National Bank can move from buyer to seller, and you can move from a structurally strong Swiss franc to a structurally weak Swiss franc, which, you know, could be very good for some of the Swiss exporters. But so I think the bottom line is we've had a rule change on Switzerland. And so I'd be wary on placing any big bets because all of a sudden you're not quite sure what the rules are. So I'd be very wary on Switzerland.
And interestingly, in that they're disposing of their gold.
Yeah. Now, no, they've, yeah.
I mean, if I ran the S&P, I'd be buying I wouldn't be buying equities anymore. I've played that game. I'm the greatest alchemist in the world. I've turned ink into real assets.
Yep.
Now I'd be acquiring as much hard assets as I possibly could because I've done it with
magic. If you still have the flows. What if you don't have the flows anymore? Then you need to sell your equities to buy the gold.
Yeah, I could start shifting some of that. So if I sold, you know, 20% of my Apple stock very quietly into a rising market. Yep. And started, yeah, now I can acquire hard assets. Now I ultimately have won the game totally.
What if the inflows have now turned to outflows?
You want that? So yeah, no.
Then you just need to sell the equities and pay back on the other side.
And yet I see UBS as, you know, as we talk about it, as a great play because to me, nobody has got a bigger footprint in private wealth management in Asia than UBS. I think UBS stopped thinking that they were going to be Goldman Sachs and are actually trying to be
I don't know. I think if you're a rich Saudi, a rich Chinese, I don't think you go to any kind of Western bank. I think you go to DBS Bank, you go to OCBC, you go to Bank of Singapore.
Go to Japanese?
You might go Japanese, but the service is horrendous. You know, I think you go to the Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank. I think if the point is you're worried about future sanctions coming at you, I don't think you go to a Western bank. You just go to local banks. Maybe you even go into a Chinese bank. You go to Bank of China in Hong Kong. Maybe because who's going to sanction them?
Maybe you go to Bank of Laomi. And the world is really shifting. Wow.
A final question on your current views on the anti-fragile assets to hold. You've recently pointed out three Chinese government bonds, gold, and energy. Can you elaborate on that? Do you still think those are anti-fragile assets?
Yeah, no, I was looking for my latest book in the back of me, and it's not even there. That's how pathetic I am. I wrote a book pretty much on this, published last summer, called Avoiding the Punch, which I thought this would be a good opportunity to plug. But yes, you know, the reality is U.S. Treasuries, German bonds are no longer anti-fragile assets. You know, you've had in the past 2 years, you've had 5% drops in the S&P 500, and on all five of these drops, or 5% or more drops, and all five of these drops, you've lost money on long-dated U.S. Treasuries. U.S. Treasuries are no longer doing the job that that you would expect them to do. What is doing the job? What is protecting portfolios and downsides? Chinese government bonds remain terrific. You know, they're the best performing major government bond market over the past 10 years, over the past 5 years, over the past 3 years, over the past 1 year. Take any, you know, year to date, take any measure you want there. It's one of the few government bond markets that's up this year, on which you didn't lose money. So I still think, you know, that still has the momentum. Nobody owns it. Flows keep coming in. Flows stopped for a few weeks following the Russian invasion because people were afraid that China would also get sanctioned. But I think, you know, it's pretty hard to sanction China when you got inflation rates at 8%, right? If you sanction China, you're going to end up with inflation rate at 25%. I think Chinese government bonds remain a great portfolio diversification tool. The other one is gold. You know, gold. Gold is tough because it adds volatility to portfolios typically, but I think gold has been behaving, you know, pretty decently in the face of higher bond yields and in the face of a stronger dollar. So, imagine what might happen if the dollar started to roll over to gold. I think it would really fly. So I'm decent, you know, gold, precious metals in general. The other asset I think you need to own in portfolios is a lot of energy. Bull markets, economic booms, bull markets end for one of two reasons, either because interest rates go up too much or because energy prices go up too much. The reality is inflation is at such levels today that interest rates can't catch up. We're in a negative real rate environment and we'll likely stay in a negative real rate environment for quite a while. So it seems unlikely, you know, you could say, well, we're going to move from -5% real to -2% real. Yippee, you know, awesome. You know, how does that kill your economy? I mean, -2% real, I'm still borrowing. I'm still expanding. I'm still spending money. And so the real risk to the system is not so much on the interest rate front, and it's on the energy front, that at some point energy prices go up enough to crash the global economy. Now, I think the U.S. is decently resilient to high energy costs because the U.S. is now self-sufficient. I think China has built in some resiliency by reopening its coal mines. And basically, as the price of energy has gone up, China's gone, you know, down the pollution charts and is just saying, okay, fine, we'll just pollute again. And the one that is really stuffed is Europe. So I think what you have to look at is the moment when high energy prices trigger a crisis in Europe. We're not there yet. So I continue to believe we're in an inflationary boom, but where you have to monitor Europe because that's the canary in the coal mine. That's what will go up bust first. And I don't know if Europe will go bust when oil hits 120 or 140 or 160, but Europe will be the victim of the high oil price, and it will be that will, you know, tip the cycle over.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
No, I love everything that Lewis is saying. When we talked about where do you buy rubles, I buy my rubles from Gerhard Schroeder, so that would be a good play. I think that really just really well. And one of the things I like in the precious metal market is platinum, though, because the Russians still mine a significant amount of platinum. We know about the palladium. Palladium's run up. South Africa, the currency's done very well lately, as Peter Buchbauer continues to point out over and over about certain currencies. And that's what makes this time a little bit different than what we've seen before. The emerging market world, which usually gets stung terribly during times of high energy and food costs, is kind of holding because their interest rates are. And Lewis says, we laugh at it, but it's true. Okay, so my money is now earning only a negative real 3% rather than negative 6%, whatever number we want to concoct. And those are conservative. So again, yeah, what are we left with? And I don't buy gold for inflation. I buy gold because I challenge the credibility of central banks. By the time the inflation hits, I think, as I learned in the early 80s, it's kind of, you know, people have already gotten there because the question is, what are the central banks going to do in response? You know, everybody's talking about Jerome Powell finding his inner Volcker here. I don't think that any central banker in the world, except maybe in Russia, has a sense of what an inner Volcker really is, to tell you the truth. They don't have the stomach for it. I was having a discussion with a friend of mine who in 2009 asked a question about to Volcker at a conference, at the CME conference, so you can verify this, in November of 2009. And he asked Paul Volcker if gold was the barometer that he measured his success as Fed chairman. Now, that's a very important question, because when Paul Volcker came in October of 1979 or whatever period, and interestingly, Lewis talks about what happened in 1971. Paul Volcker was part of the team that moved Nixon to move off the Bretton Woods and gold. And it's almost like Paul Volcker did a mea culpa, because he squeezed inflation out of the system and his barometer was breaking the gold market. I mean, gold went from, I know, I was trading it very actively from 860, 870, 880, and it settled down much lower. Not back to where it was. We never saw 41 and a quarter again, or 160, you know, so, but it did. So this Fed has no stomach for it. And we haven't even gotten the new Fed governors through Congress yet. And believe me, you can argue whether Leo Brainard's a hawk or a dove. I'm not playing that argument. I've seen the work and I've seen the comments and I followed the speeches. And Leo Brainard herself, interesting, when she did her when she delivered a couple of speeches on central bank digital currency coins, stable coins, talked about gold back, by the way. She said it. It threw me for a loop, because here is certainly a classically neo-Keynesian part of the establishment throwing that into a possible stable coin, but it was in there. So
I think they're panicking.
Oh yeah, I agree, because they've been told wrong.
I think they're panicking. I mean, so wrong. They're just panicking.
And that's my problem. You know, I'm not a Powell fan. As I say, I come to bury him and not to praise him. And what the Fed did that was so dramatically wrong is, I'm not going to argue with QE1. I'm not going to argue with what they did to stem the crisis in March and April of 2020. It's just that they didn't know when to stop. And they trusted these tremendously flawed models and kept making bigger and bigger bets. That's why they're in the terrible straits that they are. They couldn't stop themselves making a bet on very questionable models. Sorry. And now you've got a balance sheet of $9 trillion. Okay. Hubris. You know what? Let's find out what you're going to do. And the last thing I wanted to ask, so when you see them talk about quantitative tightening, where do you think this, you know, will that break the back of the over-leveraged global system?
All right. Have you had kids?
I have 4 kids.
Okay, so I'm sure you took them on road trips, and I'm sure they'd be fighting at the back of the car. And you would probably
you must know my kids.
Yeah, you would probably turn around and say, if your kids don't shut up, I'm gonna like pull the car over and abandon you on the side of the road. At least I've done that a number of times with my own kids, and I had no intention of pulling the car over, and I have no intention of abandoning them on the side of the road. I was just trying to win 30 minutes apiece. That's my view on the Fed. They talk a big game. they have no intention of pulling the car over or letting the kids go, because it would indeed unleash financial mayhem and a massive recession. The reality is, we know that inflation only ends when you either have a collapse of energy prices, which isn't in the cards, or a massive recession. I mean, those are the two things that bring down inflation. So let's not kid ourselves that there's this third magical way full of unicorns and rainbows, because that way doesn't exist. And the Fed knows it. It's just trying to buy some peace and sound credible. And you know, I think the Fed also got for 10 years, 15 years into this habit of getting the market to do what it wanted just by talking. You know, the Fed would point the way and the market would go there by itself, because you had 30 years of accumulated credibility. But this is, you know, being shot by the day. So, you know, look, if we talked 2 years ago and I had said, oh, by the way, 2 years from now, US inflation will be above 8% and the Fed will be doing $10 billion a week in QE simultaneously, you'd have thought, this guy is the biggest idiot I've ever met. You know, he is just stupid. Like, how can that be? How can you have 8% inflation and the Fed doing QE? But that's what, you know, for all the talk about QT, 2 weeks ago, they were buying $10 billion a week, just 2 weeks ago. So, you know, do you judge people on what they say, or do you judge people on what they do? The Fed is the dad driving the car saying, if you get kids, don't shut up, I'm going to pull over and drop you off. And that car is not getting pulled over.
So let me ask, so, and this is how we ended with Zoltan. So when you see the yield curve, where it is.
Yep. I just don't think there's any message in the yield curve, to be honest. It is, you know, when it's been so manipulated by central banks, not just in the US, but everywhere. It's been so manipulated by regulations. Most, you know, nobody in their right mind buys a 30-year bond yielding 2.7% when inflation's at 8. Like, nobody does that. It's, if you do that, it's because you have no choice. The regulations push you in there. You're either a pension fund that has to do this or an insurance company that has to do that. So, you know, to look at the yield curve for some kind of message, to me, it's, I don't buy it.
Yeah, it's okay. Stone cold agree. I think first of all, I think it is flattened to inverted, and you can see it coming. First, because you've removed it, because the Fed balance sheet is so big, and they don't hedge their portfolio. So when we were talking about convexity and what would be going on in the refi market, and then when rates would start going higher, it doesn't matter because the Fed does not hedge its portfolio. So you're missing a major participant who would actually be acting to steepen out the curves as they were trying to protect themselves. And yet, because they're not there, you still have the same designated buyers, and you still have Europe, of course, doing $40 billion at least until June 30th of asset purchases. So it is, the signaling mechanism is so badly broken by the central banks that they own the disaster that it portends. And that's the end of it.
Well, look, here's the thing. My take is today's inflation rate, it's not a bug, it's a feature. You know, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. The Fed has more than 1,000 PhDs working for it. I'm going to assume that these guys went to Econ 101 and that they knew that if they run money supply at 26% year on year and 9% budget deficits, they were going to end up with inflation. You know, that they knew this, they wanted this. You know, a year ago, they were telling us they wanted higher inflation. And the reason they want higher inflation is because that's how you deal with today's heavy debt burdens.
Yeah,
it's either that or default. And so deflation was a conscious policy choice. Now, we can go around saying, oh, how horrible inflation is because there's a political choice. Maybe they were hubristic enough to think, oh, you know, we'll peg it at 4 or 5%, but it'll never go above that because, you know, we're so smart and we'll manage to do this. So it's a little bit like we'll manage to get a little bit pregnant, but not too pregnant. And of course, the problem with being pregnant is you start off a little pregnant and, you know, it's you as time evolves, you get more pregnant. And this is where we are with inflation today. Inflation, you know, feeds on itself. There's a psychological element to it. And you know, they can talk to try to talk it back down, but the cat is out of the bag. And again, it's not a bug, it's a feature. And now for it to work, for it to bring down for it to bring down debt over time, the next step is you need financial repression. You need, in essence, capital controls to make sure that the money, you know, doesn't leave where it is. Because money tends, it's like water. It flows downhill. Just like water flows downhill, money flows to where it's best treated. So if you're going to treat money horribly in the US, it's going to go to places that where it doesn't get treated horribly, like China, like Brazil. Now, this is when, of course, having a war is handy, because then you can impose capital controls because, you know, the war. So we're going to move to a Western world with increased rationing, increased price controls, increased capital controls, increased export controls. This is what happens in wartime. I was just saying, so it's a bug, not a feature. It's a feature, not a bug. And that, you know, we're moving to a world with capital controls where you'll be told you're allowed to have -5% real bonds in the US, but if you don't like those, feel free to have them in Europe where you also get -5. And or if you don't like those, feel free to have them in Japan where you also get -5, and that'll be that. And yeah, again, that's the world we're moving to. A deglobalized world that we're with very different capital flows between developed markets and emerging markets.
So yes, and you know what? And the sad fact is, as you point out, the playbook for how to deal with the overhang of debt, especially as we came out of the great financial crisis, was Rogoff's scenario, which was to have inflation of 4 to 6%.
That's what they want, but it's
the cure-all.
But that doesn't mean that's what you get. That's what you want. Yeah, but you can't always get what you want. Sometimes you get more than what you want.
Oh, thank you. That's Mick Jagger. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. His son is the Prime Minister of Canada, I think. Oh, no. Yes.
No, that's Fidel Castro. That's Fidel Castro's son. Not...
Oh, that's weird. We can end that up. But that was what they wanted. They wanted, as you said, to be a little bit pregnant. So give me enough inflation so I can eradicate the debt, because that's the history of debt. And nobody knows it better than Carmen Reinhart. It's interesting now that she's serving in the role that she is, her kind of discussion becomes a little bit different, but certainly is an expert on financial repression. So,
but again, it's like being pregnant, you know. Yeah. You start off a little bit pregnant, but before you know it, usually you get a lot more pregnant.
Yeah. This absolutely, as usual, has been great. And look up what they did with Khashoggi, because I think it's an important
element. I'll look it up now.
We don't want to wait this long, because last time, and we did talk 2 years ago, and I can tell you that we laughed about it. Archer Daniel, Bungie, Freeport. Yep. We went through the litany of them at the end. Yep. Those were, you know, because we kind of
they've done okay. Coming.
Right. Those were cheap, real assets that were really cheap and had potential upside, which at that time was all we were looking for. So yep. Thank you.
And I don't think they're done running either.
No, I don't think so. I've taken some off, of course, because I'm a trader and I think I can time the markets fairly well. So that's what I try to do. So
thanks for your time, guys.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you. And the best to you.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Let's not do this. Wait so long, Richard. That's up to you.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Take care, guys.
All right. Thank you. Yeah.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.